Today, it is my pleasure to introduce Charlie Wiley, the Lupe Murchison Curator of Contemporary Art at the Dallas Museum of Art. He's been at the DMA since 1996 and celebrated his 15-year anniversary this past February. He earned his BA in American Studies from Notre Dame and his MA in the History of Art from Williams College. Prior to the DMA, he was Assistant Curator of Contemporary Art at the St. Louis Art Museum for 4 years, worked at the Lannan Foundation in Los Angeles, and interned at the Getty Museum, also in LA, in the Department of Photographs. At the Dallas Museum of Art, he's curated such projects as Performance Art, Willie Doherty, Requisite Distance, and On Kawara. He's also currently working on the installation of Mark Bradford's Mid-Career Survey to go up this October. He's organized exhibitions of the work of Ellsworth Kelly, Annette Lawrence, Robert Ryman, Sigmar Polka, Patrick Fallhaber, Thomas Struth, Bryce Martin, and Gerhard Richter. He also sits on the Cowboy Stadium art program with Michael Opping. Please join me in welcoming Charlie Wiley.
All right. Sorry about that. So Ed's work is very, very multivalent, and that means that there are so many different levels that one can begin and talk about the work. And I thought what I would do is begin with something completely on the surface, perhaps unrelated, but actually I think has a lot of interesting comparison and contrasting ideas in it, and it's this small painting here by attributed to Corot. The reason I wanted to start here is to bring about this the compare and contrasting I was talking about in terms of looking at Ed's landscape idea and how it is a natural language that I think that we can approach his that he speaks, that we can approach his work and kind of get it, and it perhaps that immediate cognition masks a lot of what I think is deeply profound about Ed's work. And to talk about the idea of landscape and the pictorial tradition and space and how space is represented on a two-dimensional rectangle. And this painting here is from the 19th century, and it really bears a lot of what Corot is known for, certainly, but also what a painting of this type would what you would look for in this type of painting, which is a landscape, for one thing. A landscape as a genre becomes important in the 19th century as never before. And one of the things that made Corot and other people kind of radical in their day, even though this looks like the most mild-mannered painting in the world, is that what it's depicting is not a mythological scene, or it's not royalty, it's not a battle, it's not all these other things that landscape was used to depict as a background, or stories as a background. It's someone who is probably working in by the riverside here, and there's their boat. It's very bucolic, it's very idyllic, but really what you're looking at is a view of a very everyday kind of occurrence and not one from history or mythology or literature or any other kind of literary or extra pictorial associations. And the thing that makes this quite wonderful is the different painting techniques that are going on here, that this is a late Corot, later in his career. His earlier work was a lot more precise and painted in a way that is a lot more geometric and precise in its representation. So what you have is this idea of brushing things on in a very loose and almost smoky kind of manner. And then he has these things up here of the leaves. This is a very well-known Corot idea to touch the canvas very briefly with the brushstroke to replicate the idea of leaves and shimmering leaves in a tree. And then the other thing is this idea of the distant landscape that correlates to how the eye sees landscape in a more fuzzy way. The further back it gets, the further indistinct it becomes. And yet what we do recognize is this idea of a land form across the river. I imagine this is a river or some kind of lake, and then when you start to look further, you see that there's a town or maybe a castle or some kind of architecture and building there. Right in the center, there's a nice, even kind of composition that's going on here. This comes down here in a very, this diagonal comes down in a very gentle way. So what you're seeing is a very rational, pleasing, kind of relaxing, in a way, depiction of nature at its finest, in a way, where you are able to project yourself into the scene and all is well and right with the world. I think the depiction of space is one that goes from, and this is very deliberate, goes from where he takes the brush with the yellow and makes these things up on the surface, and as well as we were talking just beforehand, this little red dot of the hat, which is the only kind of tonality except for the roofs up here that is the brown or the red, and that brings the composition forward, makes it a little bit flatter, and then it recedes into space until you get the clouds and then the infinite idea of the sky behind the clouds. And so there's quite a bit of projectile space going on here in what Corot is doing. So in the 19th century, this would be a painting that would probably have been done for the market, and he did quite a bit of paintings. Corot was very prolific in his work. We have a number at the Dallas, or we have a few at the Dallas Museum of Art that are really quite spectacular. And so what he was doing was seeing what was around him and of the contemporary landscape that was around him and bringing it back into the studio and representing it through these various conventions that I was just talking about. Now, what I'd like to do is move into the exhibition, the Richer Show, and talk about the idea of space and a different formulation of the kind of space that I'm talking about. You're so nice to come. So, this is not a work of art. It's a map. It is a map of Ed's relationship to Los Angeles. And Fran, if you want to talk about Southern California, please do. This is the person expert on Southern California and its art and cultural life. This is another way of looking at space and the intervening notion of a landscape and the fuzziness of the landscape and the depth that you get, the sky, the conventions of nature is a pleasant place to be. All of that is absent from this depiction of space, but if you think about it, they're both very much ideas of how to register one's place in a landscape, in land. In this case, you're not seeing it from a landscape, you're seeing it from an omniscient viewpoint of above, and now that we have Google Maps that you can see it on your computer from above, it's even makes it even more omniscient in a certain way. But for before we have mapped the world from the air, this is still how we get around. This is still very useful to us in locating where we are, and it has a use value, meaning that when you're in Los Angeles, if you don't know the city, these things are crucial. Before GPS, of course, and before the voice that tells you to turn left or right on La Cienega, or get yourself completely turned around. So I think what is interesting about this being here is that it not only shows you where Ed's projects were, and the Sunset Strip is, there's so many here you can't even tell what's going on, but all these ideas of the studios, these books that Ed created where he went around and did a topographical survey of the landscape of Los Angeles, it's very interesting to me in terms of the idea of space and expanse that his work encompasses. And there's also an idea of codifying it And there is a wonderful idea of the postmodern idea of, well, is he really serious in many of the things that he's doing? So that you have these conventions that I'll talk about in a second that come from very romantic ideas about landscape, about space, but then they're brought up very short in terms of other kinds of conventions that include irony and extra pictorial ideas coming into what we would assume to be a unified whole. And I'll talk about that and what I mean about those big words in a second. But this is Ruscha land. You know, this is a depiction of what Ed's subject matter really has been since he went west in the 1950s to attend art school. And one of the fascinating facts that I found out on reading and rereading the catalog was that he went west from Oklahoma City with his friend. It took them 3 days to get there. He was going to attend art school, and this is such a different thing between today and in the 1950s. He didn't know which art school he was going to go to when he went, and so it's this real idea of real adventure, you know, like, wow. Set out from Oklahoma City with a friend of yours and drive all that way and get there and realize, wow, the school I wanted to go to didn't accept me, so I guess I have to go to another school. So that's when he went to Chouinard. That's why he went to Chouinard, and the rest is history. And what he found there was very different than what is there today. And it was a much, and I lived in LA, and even since I lived in LA in late 80s, early 90s, it's changed irrevocably in many ways. But it was a lot different in terms of the idea of traffic. And one of the great things that he talks about, and I'm getting a little off track here, but one of the great things he talks about in the interview with Michael is how he didn't have a car. After he drove out to LA, he drove it back, and I'm not sure how he got back to LA, but he didn't have a car for 2 or 3 years. And Michael asked him, you know, was that a problem? And he said, well, actually it wasn't, because there were streetcars in LA that they took a lot, which is unimaginable right now to think about that. And also that he was a student, and so there was, someone had a car in the house, et cetera, et cetera. But he talks about his lifelong interest in the car, and that's what the show is about, is how the car and travel and what the car makes possible is so integral to his work and to his life experience. So I'd like to move into the next gallery and talk about some iconic paintings. Excuse me. So, everyone's standing back because it's such a iconic painting, and we all want this giant view on it, of course. I mean, that's fantastic. That's exactly what this painting's about, is the long view. This is the Standard Station with 10 Cent Western being torn in half from 1964. And when Ed got to Los Angeles, when he was doing his early work, he focused on many things that are present in this. And in 64, this is a tremendous kind of early masterpiece of his. And certainly this painting and the Dartmouth painting are two of the great icons of the pop art school, which Ed helped to define, even being on the West Coast, which suffered a little bit of East Coast negligence, I think, for a long time. But what is interesting about this painting is what I was talking about before about Corot and space. If you look at this sky is absolutely flat. It doesn't let you in, really. It is a very cinematic treatment, and Michael mentions this, of course, about the windshield and the screen, about film and the idea of a Technicolor presentation. This is an epic kind of presentation of what was to Ed a very important place when he was going from Oklahoma City to Los Angeles. And he talks about how it's, again, it's so different in a way than today, where we have something to tell us in our pocket where the next gas station is going to be. When you put yourself back into the place of driving out west at that point, these places became to Ed these kinds of beacons in the night about where you would be able to stop. And he talks about them being like a little microcosm of a Western town. There were people who were working there who were, there was food to sell, and there was obviously gas and oil to sell. There were provisions, and they were out there in the middle of nowhere. And so coming across them, he had always felt that there was this idea of a beacon in the distance and how they were necessary. In gas stations to him were much more than just, you know, a place where you would fill up. They became a symbol of, you know, light in the landscape. They became a place where you stopped and got the things that you needed to go on. All these kinds of metaphysical ideas of, you know, coming from something as plain spoken as a gas station is something that Ed repeats and repeats. And what he does as well is, and he talks about this, as, and I'm going to quote, and where you get this visual, diagonal, he says, "I always liked the architecture of gas stations. They had zoom quality, the way they projected themselves in space. The signs for the stations were lifted up in the air, and they really caught your eye, and the gas station was a sleek metal box sitting under it. I loved that roof overhang of a gas station. In those days, it was connected to the office and garage of the station. The way they swept off the building was like a huge wing. It's a very modern, almost abstract image, but they're different. They still have a meaning to me. Maybe the idea that you can create shade with an abstract form. I always thought it would be good to live in one of them. It is a very progressive form of architecture." And that what he was talking about in terms of the zoom quality is immediately apparent to us. And he himself worked in the graphic design field and is very much aware of how visual information is arranged on a flat surface. And so what is this except a kind of glorification, this wonderful glorification of something that is very mundane, and that one can go into a lot of different ideas about early notion of branding that we all are aware of right now, the idea of pop art and the glorification of products, but also a questioning of it in a certain way, and the irony of not depicting something that, you know, is a government building or a house of worship or another kind of venerated architecture, but giving this massive canvas over to a gas station. And I think that irony is inherent in the work, but I also think that's where Ed is really interesting, because there's also a sincerity to it that, you know, when you hear him talk about it, when you read him talk about it, that idea of actually it meaning quite a bit to him is it's this double-edged sword. And it's this idea of a consciousness of falling for it, but also knowing that you're falling for it. And I think that is something that you hear, or that I feel throughout Ed's work. And it in the front room, in, there's this idea of clouds and light, and almost a kind of metaphysical or mystical treatment of light, which you could do a whole show about Ed's treatment of light and how it represents, you know, some kind of spiritual, metaphysical, universal, cosmic idea of being in time. But it also is brought up you're brought up short in a certain way also by his humor and his irony. Yeah. And so that idea of irony and also the idea of flat space is very much apparent in what's coming up here, because you have this notion of this kind of grand, wonderful thing about the gas station, and then all of a sudden what's up here, it looks like it's on a table or something. He paints it like it has a shadow, and so there's some kind of light source coming up here, and maybe this is sitting on some kind of table front, and we're looking at two completely different paintings in one. And how does how does that happen? And so clearly there's this idea of flatness and space that he is putting into contrast one and the other. The popular Western, of course, this is his idea of the West from here to Los Angeles, this notion of the West and the mythologies of the West. And if you wanted to look at it, you know, this, it's torn. And so I don't think that's just a, you know, I think there's some kind of symbol behind there that, you know, the old days have passed. Those mythologies are being literally maybe torn apart in this age. Yet this is the new face of it, and it's also quite fascinating. You know, so this is the new West, the old West. The old West is, you know, you don't want to lay too much of a value judgment on this in many ways, but in another sense, it's like that could be considered the old West. And this is a three-dimensional object that he has been painstakingly placed on the canvas here. And it's Michael brings up this idea of popular and standard in the titles as well. These kinds of general marketing phrases that we are very conversant with at this time. And the notion of the shadows here that he portrays is what he was talking about with the shadow here too. You know, that there are all sorts of different kinds of presentation of space, both flat and deep, that he is working with here. And it's a fascinating thing to contrast, you know, all of this layering of objects and composition that really does give you a much deeper sense of space, even though this is a flat blue, and then up here, which completely disorients you in a way to what the painting's about. And I wanted to, with that in mind, I wanted to talk about the other big one. So what I find interesting about this painting in contrast to the one we just looked at is that this one is basically the primary colors. So it's very elemental, red, yellow, blue. It's very, and black and white. And the detail is brought out a little bit more or at least it's a little bit more apparent in the fluorescent lights. Look at these Dan Flavins right here. And the Klieg lights. You know, this is like a Hollywood opening or something that Michael talks about, and which I thought of too. And set against this very, very beautiful, dark evocation of the night sky. And this is a really, in contrast to that, you know, overt irony in a sense, this is much more a kind of romantic idea of the gas station and how beautiful it is and how perfect it is and how much this could be a beacon in the night, as we were talking about before. The idea of a sanctuary, of a place to rest, of an oasis in the middle of the night. And the exhibition ends with Ed's recent book on the Road, which was the Jack Kerouac novel that was published in the late 1950s. He started it in the late 1940s, and Ed had always wanted to do a book based on the Road, and the Kerouac book kind of broke open the whole notion of the Beat Generation and their thirsting for experience. And many of On the Road itself, of course, by the title, lets you know that what they were after and the vehicle, if you will, for that searching for thrills and adventure and something to, you know, go after experience, the way they did that was to take car trips back and forth across the United States. And so the book On the Road was very much in Ed's mind throughout his career, according to him. And this is an early kind of, not completely contemporary, just a little bit after, but another kind of idea of representing the road and what is possible there and what you find there and the kind of glamorous thing that it is to be traveling like that in a kind of almost like a space journey, that this is rendered a real magical, mystical almost idea of architecture. And here, I think this is fascinating because it talks about, you know, these lines that are coming out. It talks about the artifice of what we're seeing, and that there is a there's something that goes beyond that, or this is done according to geometric principles in a way that these that this plane, these planes extend beyond, and there's like this little, I don't know, Mondrian suggestion going on here. Could it be? I don't know. There's a, you know, this flatness and the primary colors that I was talking about. I don't know. Maybe he is thinking along those lines. But Mondrian, of course, is flat and right angles. And what we have here in relation to the idea of speed in a car, rearing up, you know, when you drive up to some place and that you're driving past it, that there's this, you know, idea of a panorama that you always see. And this is also something, it's really quite fascinating to think about de Kooning's work on Montauk Highway, where he takes the idea from an abstract expressionist viewpoint and creates these evocations of sight and blur and paint and this marvelous series of paintings that he did in the Montauk Highway. And here, it's a lot different. The notion is one of precision and a more conventional, obviously representational idea, but absolutely nothing to do, really, with nature. And if you think of de Kooning in his work, looking at the trees and the sky, it's all about this kind of nature. And this, it's not about nature. This is pretty much all man-made. All the light sources are man-made. The blue is one that, you know, here again, it's like, is it or isn't it? Is it the deep blue sky, or is it some kind of backdrop that he's showing us? You know, how far do you want to take this romantic idea? Where do you invest yourself in this? Is it a celebration of being on the road? Is it a celebration of gas stations and the lonely light on the distance and this idea of finding a home in the universe? Or is it more akin to advertising? Is it a comment on the banality of such things and how value has been attributed to corporations, to branding, to gas itself, the gas industry itself? Where do you fall on that spectrum? And so I think that this is an icon for a reason. You know, it sums up, I think, a moment in certainly art history, and in terms of the pop art movement, in terms of this idea of flatness and the adaptation of logos and the commercial subject matter. But in a way, it's also a record of an ascendant ascendant thing that we all live with now, which is the things that we buy from corporations that we know their names. You know, whereas before, I think it was a little looser in a certain way, but now we are so defined by that which we carry and use and buy. And I think, even the name standard is hilarious because it's, you know, standard. Like, who wants anything standard now? Would you ever even be able to make a product or an object or get someone to buy something if you called it standard? Probably not, because if it's standard, it's not the best thing in the world, and we all want the best things in the world, right? We're going to be paying for it. And so there's a whole chapter or thesis one could do on the idea of commerce and representation of commerce that goes beyond our kind of glib idea of what, or at least, you know, many times what I've thought about pop art. You know, it's very much about a surface idea, and you read that it is about celebratory notions, but the idea of critique, except for Warhol's Death and Disasters, is not necessarily as much in analysis of pop. And I think that a painting like this lends itself to thinking about those ideas in this very dazzling kind of, literally like kind of dazzling kind of presentation. So I wanted to end in the first room, kind of going, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Right. Well, I think the glamour comes from the Klieg Light idea. You know, to me, it's like, why would a gas station have Klieg Lights around it? You know. I agree. I would agree with you on that. Like, I don't, you know, I agree. It raises it, but isn't it? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And maybe, I don't know, maybe I've seen it so often reproduced that it's become glamorous in a certain way because it's so famous, you know? Maybe that's where the idea of glamour comes from. That's like the thing about Ruscha's work, you know? It's like, and that's what I want to talk